What's up, everybody?
Y'all getting stir crazy amidst this quarantine, COVID-19 and all? You eating all the bad stuff in the house and getting a little doughy? Tell you what, I had a solo party with all the booze and the records in my house until about 4 a.m. last night, so it appears that the party can happen regardless of how many people are there. In any case, today's guest is drummer Matt Griner of Pennsylvania's August Burns Red, who I caught up with during said COVID-19 lockdown to talk about their new record Guardians, due out this Thursday, April 4th. His holy trinity of working on drum parts, a funny Meshuggah story, working on farms, an actual tractor talk, not like literally, we actually talked about tractors, and a whole lot more. So hope y'all enjoy it. Given the present world in which we live, I hope to be doing more of these remote interviews, so stay tuned. In the meantime, if you like what you hear, Crash Bang Boom Podcast can be found on iTunes Podcast, my SoundCloud and YouTube pages, Stitcher, Luminary, Google Play, Podbean, and more. Feel free to check out any of the previous 170-plus episodes. Give me a like, a subscription, a positive rating, and or a glowing review. You can also find me on Facebook and Instagram, where you can get additional content and updates. So check it out and give me a like. Shout out to my sponsor, New Orleans Record Press. If you're looking to release vinyl, go on over to NewOrleansRecordPress.com to look at the myriad vinyl coloring, packaging, mastering, electroplating, lacquer cutting, and more options. And you can use that handy little real-time quote generator to keep tabs on everything, and they print both 12 and 7-inch records in 150 and 180-gram variants. So give them a look-see, and that's NewOrleansRecordPress.com. So here we go. Matt Griner, August Burns Red. Guardians out this Thursday, April 4th. Get up on it. Crash, bang, boom.
Crowds go mad with joy.
All right, Matt Griner of August Burns Red. What's happening, man? How might you be making out?
I'm here. I'm alive. Thanks for having me on. It's good to have something to do. Although I have been anything but sitting around. But I guess we should mention it's a Friday night at 9:25 p.m. and here we are doing a podcast. So the question begs to be asked, would we be doing this if we weren't quarantined?
Maybe not. But I'm glad that we're doing it, if it's any consolation.
I am too. I'm happy to be here.
Well, man, how is this coronavirus quarantine, whatever else you want to add to that descriptor? How is that working out for you, and what's been going on? Are you just locked inside your house playing inverted paradiddles and patty flafflas? What's happening, man? Are you geeking out? Are you brushing up on all the things you said you would do that you've never done previously?
Oh, that's funny. I was talking to a friend today, and he sent me a meme, which are abundant this week and last week.
Yeah, they are.
And hilarious. And the meme had something to do with someone talking to themselves and being isolated and alone. I was like, I don't feel like that at all. I was like, I've had one of the busiest weeks of my life. I just got done teaching 51 lessons, virtual lessons this week.
Wow.
I have a lot of really awesome students. So I've been hearing conversations about how COVID-19 is affecting them. And it's a interesting, almost like a case study and a micro look into what it's like and how it's affecting people around the world. From a student in the UK to a student in Florida to a student in Australia. It's very interesting. Beyond that, this really hasn't affected me all that much. I have a farm. Farming must continue. So I went and picked up things that I needed to pick up to get ready for the season, which starts in probably 2 weeks as far as planting corn and soybeans. So that side of my life really is unaffected. And I guess more than anything, my heart just goes out to people who are hurting right now, you know, and just have a lot of stress and anxiety and concern, because no one knows what's going on. And anybody that says that they do is full of it, because no one knows what's going on. That's just how it is right now.
I'll talk to you about teaching lessons at some point. I didn't realize that you had that many students. That's really cool.
Yeah.
Out of curiosity, I know that y'all have a new record coming out April 4th named Guardians. How has this affected that because, I mean, I know that on a promotional level and like a PR level, et cetera, you know, a lot of wheels get into motion towards releases and everything's gears up, and then you have tours, and then you have a lot of things that line up with that. So how is some of how has this affected y'all at this level, or has it?
Well, that was very well stated. In fact, your question has a lot of answers in it, I think, in that typically when you set up for an album release, you do it in a way that is methodical. You have a tour lined up. You have a lot of face time with your fans and a lot of content for your social media. As you may know, we were on tour with Killswitch Engage for 3 days, and then we went home. And we did have the conversation, should we postpone the release? We, in the end, decided that the best option was to release it and to do everything we could between that decision, which was about a week ago, and April 3rd, which is when Guardians comes out, to promote it.
Right.
We are the kind of band who's very proactive, and everyone in the band works really, really hard. I'm in a band with the best, hardest working people, some of the best and hardest working people I've ever met. Certainly the only people I'd want to be in a band with. And we've always been like that. And so when it comes to putting out an album, it's really no different than setting up for a tour. You work hard at it every single day, and you do everything you can to get the word out, staying connected to your fans, doing as much press as possible, doing silly videos for Instagram, and then cool playthroughs, and you know, everything that you can do. Content is king. And so the album is still going to come out. No, we don't have as much heat as we would have had we been on tour with Killswitch. But there's a silver lining. I think people are at home. And if they're, well, I don't think, I know people are at home. And I think that they will be excited to have something new to listen to. We've released 3 singles, the most recent of which was Paramount. People's reaction seem to be pretty positive, and I think that excitement will carry over for the next week until, boom, the album drops.
Are there any estimations as to when y'all might be getting back out on the road, or is it just everything in limbo? And I mean, how does that even work?
That's a good question. There is a tentative tour schedule for the Killswitch makeup dates.
Okay.
But as you know, living in New York, we're only a state away. So, you know, if this thing is a tsunami in New York, then we better set up some walls, I guess, down here, right? To try to keep the waves from crashing over.
I don't even know, man. It's crazy.
Right. So everything is at this point, everything's tentative. I said to JB on the phone the other day, the guitarist for the band, I said, I would just plan for the worst for this year and expect the best.
Yeah.
But we can certainly plan to do the tour again, and we do have some tentative routing and planning. It's even in our iCal. It's pretty it's pretty solid, but it's all gonna fall apart just as quickly as the tour that we were just like literally on, packed up for, playing shows on, and we headed home. And we're a small piece in the pot. I mean, NCAA canceled, All Pro Sports canceled. Like, this is so much bigger than being a band on tour.
Right.
And in fact, I've never looked at it as like, man, we're so disadvantaged being in the music industry. I feel like, we're hurting for sure, and some of us will struggle more than others to bounce back, but everybody's hurting. This has affected every corner of the market.
Yeah, global economic effect, undeniable. It's insane. And no precedent for it. It's hard to even tell how we rebound or what all this even means.
Right, it's unprecedented. Exactly.
Absolutely. Well, you mentioned being on a farm, so I'd like to talk to you a little bit about that. I know, are y'all all from Lancaster, Pennsylvania, or around that area?
Yeah, yep. I live in a small town called Lititz, and that's 8 minutes from Mannheim. Last year, I bought half of my dad's farm. It's about 70 acres is what I own.
And, whoa.
It's another full-time job.
Right.
Very cathartic for me. There's not a lot of money in farming, as you may well know, especially at that level. It's very small in comparison. Midwest farms are like 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 acres. Ours is 140 total. and our tractors are from the 70s. We do a lot by hand. We're always fixing broken equipment. The second you go out and buy something new, you shoot yourself in the foot. Your profit for the next decade goes out the window. And additionally, it's hard to work on new stuff. It's like, it's impossible, actually. You have to have someone service it. So, it's a family operation. It's actually where I started the band. We started August Burns Red on my dad's farm, and we wrote Thrill Seeker, Messengers, Constellations, all in the chicken house of the farm. In fact, our publishing company's name still to this day is Egg Room Publishing, because that's where we were practicing, in an egg room, when we started our publishing deal.
Wow, that's crazy, man. Yeah. You mentioned old tractors and stuff. My dad, he's down in southeast Louisiana, about an hour north of New Orleans. He's out on like 40 acres.
Oh yeah,
which by most accounts is a lot.
Yeah,
but he has a 60-year-old Massey Ferguson tractor that still runs to this day.
That's awesome.
That thing still runs to this day.
That's awesome. They're heavy, they're slow, and they're solid, and there's very few electronics on them. So if something breaks, I bet your dad knows how to fix it with a wrench and some WD-40.
You got it. And you know, I got to say, in 175 plus episodes, this is the first time I've ever talked to anyone about tractors. So congratulations.
I was talking to someone before this, and I said, I'm about to do an interview with someone who has done a lot of interviews. And presumably, this similar questions will be asked, and my goal is to try to implement information that is not standard. So maybe your audience will be completely bored out of their minds, but at the very least, this is new. So fresh.
Absolutely, man. Oh, that's hilarious. Well, as mentioned earlier, new record coming out. I was listening to it, and as I was saying earlier, it's big, it's powerful, plenty of clarity, just an all around nice, big, heavy production. So congrats on the overall sound of it.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
As to the process in which you recorded it, both in writing it, recording it, and the post-production, tell me a little bit about that process, because on some of those songs, I forget which song in particular of the three or so that you've released thus far, but there was one in particular that I could hear some pretty fairly drastic tempo changes. So I like to talk to drummers about tempo mapping and how that works, and or if you tempo map, or if y'all just did it live, or you know. So tell me a little bit about the recording and writing of this record.
Right. So everything we do is to a click track. We don't even do a drum solo live to just an improv speed. Everything's to click. My guitarist JB wrote probably half the songs, and our bass player Dustin wrote the other half. They send the songs to me, just like basically scratch or MIDI versions of them, and then I'll write my drum parts to those songs at home in my studio. And that takes me a long time. The process that I use to write drum parts is part, it speaks to why I love playing drums still to this day, 18 years later. And it's the creation side of playing drums. So I use this process, creation, memorization, application. So what I'll do is I'll listen to, say, JB's guitar riff over and over again, and I'll just start to create a sticking for it. That's the creation phase. Once I'm happy with the sticking, maybe an hour or two or 3 hours later, or the foot pattern, whatever it is, if it's a rhythm, then I'll segue into the memorization part of it, which is where I'm sitting there and I'm able to talk over top of this pattern. Okay, now I feel like I have it memorized, or I can slow it down, or I can change what I'm hitting. Once I've created it and memorized it, the third and final phase is the application. And this is where I just, you know, every time I just fall back in love with drumming, in that, say it's a paradiddle. You know, most drummers can play a paradiddle at some level. A lot of people can play a paradiddle if you just show them how to play it. But you create that, even though you didn't come up with it, you create it for yourself, you memorize it, and then you apply it. And there are ways to apply a paradiddle in a way that not a lot of drummers have used it, which is funny when you think about it, because how could that be? But the beauty of drumming is that we're all playing similar drum beats. There's only so many to go around, and yet the goal of drumming, really, the art, is to disguise what you're playing in a way that it doesn't really sound like what everybody else is playing. That's what I love about drumming. And so when I was writing this record, just like all the other ones, I use that process. And when I get to the application phase, I try to implement my bells or splash or mini china or polyrhythms, and just really try to make it interesting and creative. So outside of drumming, I wrote 5 or 6 lyrics for the record. And the way August Burns Red works is we're very democratic. So if someone has an idea for me on drums and it's better than the idea I had, we'll use it. In the same way, if I write lyrics that are better than somebody else's, we're going to use them just because we want the best final product. And that's pretty unique aspect of the band. And so I wrote the lyrics to Defender. And that was the first single we released. And then I wrote the lyrics to Paramount, which is the song that just came out this last week.
Oh, cool. Well, I guess when it came down to the actual recording of this record, was there any particularly challenging aspect of it and or different from its predecessors or any particular struggles, et cetera, that you dealt with?
I don't think we had anything out of the ordinary. One thing we did that was pretty fun, we ended up recording a sample library. So after I was done recording drums, I stuck around a couple extra days and we recorded 4 or 5 different snare drums, 6 or 7 different toms, 4 different kick drums. And the process was tedious. You just have to like sit there hitting a hi-hat for 1.5 hours to capture all the different dynamics.
Right.
The neat thing is that we ended up using the snare samples on the record from the sample library that I built. So to my knowledge, we did not use any like slate samples or any of the stock, you know, overdub samples on my drum sounds. It was all drum sounds that I recorded in-house that were used and mixed.
That's awesome, man. Congrats on that. That's really cool.
Yeah. Yeah, that was special. But I don't think there was anything difficult or out. In fact, I would say it was an easier process. We recorded in York, which is about 45 minutes away, and they have hotel rooms, sort of like apartment rooms in the studio space. And so I was actually able to just sleep there. And I'd track all day until like 6, practice at night, wake up early, practice, and then record from 10 to 6. And that was that was freaking awesome.
I bet. How many days did it take you to nail down all the tracks?
It took me a while. I think we set up probably took 2 days just to get set up, tune, get samples.
Wow.
And then once we were rolling, it probably took me 7.
Wow.
Yeah, we spent a lot of time. Yep. We spent a lot of time just to get everything right. And I would say with confidence, this is the first time probably since Constellations that I put everything in intentionally. Every single sticking is exactly the way it should be. There's no leaf unturned. On some records, you know how it is, where you go in, you record, and you don't really know where everything is and how everything sounds, and you're not really sure about every part. With this, it's like I know because I went back and forth on every single second of every single song.
Right. So when I talked to Matt Halpern recently from Periphery, I was talking to him about tempo mapping in the studio and this and that and the other. And he was saying when it comes to them recording, it sounds like you have a similar workflow kind of as to the way that Periphery does it to some extent. Because he said when he goes into the studio, he knows what he's doing. They've gone over it so many times. There's been so much pre-production, which is great that if you can do that, that's awesome. I guess in recording these songs, do you go part by part? Because that's actually what Matt was saying that he does, sort of in an attempt to maintain some continuity with drum tuning, because you know lugs get loose, tension rods, etc., and then you know snares can change this and that and the other. So he does it part by part, which I thought was really interesting, and especially I guess with the tempo mapping thing, how I had mentioned that, you know, with some of the tempo changes and whatnot. I guess at that point, do you try to get an entire song in a take, or is it kind of in some of those tougher parts? Is it like, all right, I'll do this kind of part by part?
I do the whole song. Start at the beginning, I play the whole way to the end. There was one song that I did not do that. And it was a song that was written while we were in the studio, and I just didn't have much time with it. So the only reason I would do something like that is if I just didn't have the song memorized. Because our songs move so quickly and they're mostly linear, in other words, a lot of parts just don't repeat, there would be no reason to try to record drums to a whole song if I didn't really know the song. In most cases, I know the song, I know exactly what I'm going to play, and I'm just going to record it four or five times and then take the best from each playlist. That's sort of the standard for how we record now. You play the whole way through, keep your momentum, tune after every take, and once you have four or five playlists, you go back into the control room, sit down, listen to them, and you compile the best from each playlist, which in my case is oftentimes the first or the second takes.
I'm with you on that.
I usually don't get better. Yeah.
100%.
Yeah. Yep. First time, man. I have a podcast, and my friend and I were talking on there. It's called Holy Ghost Notes. I have a theory. I think that there is something negative happening psychologically to human beings who are getting so comfortable and used to recording in Pro Tools or Logic or whatever it is, recording digitally. And here's what I mean. You know that you have a chance to redo what you just did. And so the argument that I was making was, are we giving our best right up front, or are we recording with this thought in the back of our heads that we're going to do it again because we know it's a pretty easy thing to do? We have the possibility, we have the option. And the point I used to prove that it's psychologically damaging is the fact that you'll record something once, and before you even hear it back, you'll say, okay, I want to do that again. And of course, you know better than somebody else does if you played well. But oftentimes, you get to the end of 4, 5, 6, 7, 10, 15 takes, and you're still not where you think you should be. And so it's either that, A, it's you're not giving your best up front knowing you can do it again, or B, we have this idea of what it should sound like based on how we've recorded in the past. But what we've recorded in the past has been quantized and fixed up and beat detected and perfected. And we've almost forgotten the fact that we didn't play it that way. And so when we get into the studio the subsequent time, we go to record, and when we can't get it to that level, we say, well, I'll do it again. I'll do it again. And we never get it to that level because it's inhuman. And so it's the standard, and it's the way we do things. But I did have that thought in the studio last time. I wonder how this will play out in the next decade. I couldn't stand being a producer. Oh my gosh, having to hear the same thing over and over, and having to hear the musician go, I want to do that again, I want to do that again. I would just be like, nope, sorry, dude. Yeah. Like, we're going to quantize this and just make it perfect. You know what I mean?
Right. Yep. It's one of those things, because I spoke to John Longstreth, who's, you know, absolutely at the forefront of so much of that kind of extreme, you know, metal playing between blast beats, super high BPMs, doing doubles on his feet at just absurd BPMs. And even he said, you know, like, how many more quote unquote perfect death metal records can we make? And I think that that's, if coming from a guy who is immersed in that world. I think at some point, given the general pendulous nature of the way mankind seems to work, be it ideologically, artistically, creatively, etc., I would imagine that at some point we're going to come back to deviating more and more from the post-production, sort of making it more and more devoid of what its original intent was. I think that that is part of what you're talking about, is that, you know, maybe prepare yourself to the extent that you go in not expecting to have it corrected, and just play what you feel that you need to deliver and stick to it.
Right. Exactly. That's exactly right. Then you wouldn't be doing so many takes, because you'd be like, yep, that's good. And the producer right. would be like, you sure you don't want to do it again?
Right. And of course, it comes down to a life balance. I mean, of course, if I was just, you know, financially set and I could just go to a studio or just had a house where I had my kit set up and I could just play every day like I used to be able to do when I was younger, you know, now it's like between having a,
yeah.
A job, a wife, a son,
yep.
and everything else, I have to cut out little moments of time to just go there and try to run stuff. And then as it comes closer to the actual day of recording, I try to do it every day leading up, like 2 weeks leading up. And that is generally for the last probably decade
yep.
in my mode of working to really get my mind into it, because I don't have the time anymore to just
no.
dedicate it like that. So I have to carve out every minute that I can dedicate to it, which is a balancing act.
I know. Life gets busy, man. When you're 20, you're like, oh, this is I'm gonna play drums all the time, and then you get to be, and then 30 happens and it's like, wow, the 20s were great.
Oh man, I'm 43 now, so I'm like, 30s were pretty good.
That's pretty funny. Yeah, you're probably, I mean, you are right, because you would know better than me. I'm 34, so I trust you.
Yeah, man. One thing that I wanted to ask you, I don't know if there's any particular influence for your band, but there are some 16th note runs that y'all tend to do on the tail end of your riffs that remind me a little bit of the band Psychroptic from Tasmania.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you're familiar with them, but are there any, I guess, particular bands that you feel like y'all kind of have a kinship with in what y'all do?
Yeah, I think we've always been influenced by Between the Buried and Me. JB, I think, is influenced a bit by Killswitch Engage.
Mm-hmm.
I am influenced by a wide range of music, but definitely bands from like 15 years ago are still influencing me in metal, at least. Bands like Unearth
uh-huh.
and uh-huh. Under Oath and uh-huh. Extol, Meshuggah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Any music that has a good drummer, I can think of cool beats based on that. But I've always written from this. I just always have drum beats floating around in my head, and when I hear a riff, I sit down and I use that creation memorization application structure to come up with stuff. But we don't really listen to a lot of metal. Like a lot of metal bands, we just don't. I think a lot of the guys listen to podcasts, and I don't really listen to music to listen to it per se. I listen to the radio so that I don't really analyze it. It's just sort of background music, because uh-huh. being a drummer, I analyze everything. So if I listen to a metal song, I'm just going to pick it apart the first time through it and sort of know how it goes, and it's harder to right. enjoy it that way.
Yeah, for sure, man. Have you seen Meshuggah live recently by any chance? You mentioned them, and it's one of those things where I think about any sort of quote-unquote djent subgenre, or even in the hardcore breakdowns with the you know, double bass breaking up, you know, 16th notes and whatnot. Meshuggah is one of those bands that's been so broadly influential, and they're so sick to see live. I've seen them. Every time they come to New York, I go see them, man. I don't know if you've seen them recently, but damn.
Yeah, we actually played with them in Europe at a festival, and awesome. I was walking back to the van and trailer. We had finished, and we were about to head out. They hadn't played yet. I was walking by a catering tent, and there's Tomas and his drum techs. I went up and said hi. I was talking to him, and Tomas was like, yeah, I need a drum carpet. And I was like, well, I'll just give you mine. We're about to leave. I'll just buy another one at Walmart. So he's like, really? So we walked out to my trailer, and I had to like unload a third of the, I would say that probably a quarter of the trailer to get to the drum carpet. And he's just sort of standing there, you know, and I get it out of the trailer, and he didn't know this at the time, but I had sort of an ulterior motive. My drum tech, Adam, and I have this thing called Meshuggah. And what you do for Meshuggah is you have the front facing camera looking out at like a peaceful landscape, and then mm-hmm. you turn the camera around, and it's you wearing like blue collar dad black tinted sunglasses with like a stone cold face. And as soon as you do that, you edit Meshuggah into it. So you just look hard.
Nice.
So we said, so we explained this to Tomas. We said, dude, we got to have you in it. And we'll put Bleed over top of it. We'll have like this nice park, turn the phone around, and there you are. And oh people knew about Meshuggah, and, you know, like our followers were like, you know, they thought it was funny. And so this was really going to be great. So we asked him, and he said, no. He's like, no. And we're like, wait, what? He's like, I don't do that kind of stuff. And I said, well, okay, hold on a second. I was like, I just gave you my drum carpet. Like, I just unloaded some of my trailer to give you my drum carpet. And he's like, okay. So we actually ended up getting this. And he was so pissed about it. The video turned out terrible. Like, it's not what we wanted it to be at all.
Oh no!
Because he just wasn't into it. You know, he didn't want to do it.
Oh my god, that's hilarious! Yeah, Holy moly,
it was funny.
Well, man, what's your story with drumming? How did you get into it, and at what age?
I was about 14. I was playing piano. I didn't really like playing piano, but I liked the rhythmic side of it. One day we were headed back to my house in my mom's car. I was sitting in the passenger seat. I remember exactly where I was, and I just started tapping on the dash of the car with my pinky and then going across my fingers like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3. And I, without really knowing anything about drumming or rhythm, I just was like fascinated that when you counted five or counted four, it landed on a different finger every time, like as you went back and forth. And it's funny because that same stuff still like thrills me on the kit when I'll do an arpeggio or I'll do a pi rhythm, and it won't repeat or start over until the lowest common multiple comes around. I love that. And that's like my earliest memory of when I knew that this is like what I wanted to do next. I couldn't have imagined it would have been my career, you know, would have been my career. But I started playing and started the band, and we were all terrible at our instruments, and honestly we just practiced our butts off. Like at any free time that we had, we would get done with work, and I'd go up to the chicken house, take my shirt off, sweat for 3 hours playing drums, go in, shower, go to bed, wake up, work landscaping all day, come home, do it all over again. Like, and the whole day landscaping, the only thing I think I could think about was what drum beat I wanted to play or what rhythm I wanted to write when I got home. And that would have been when I was like 17, 18, 19, 20, somewhere in that range.
Wow. Damn, man. What were some of the drummers that you were digging in those early formative years? And do you feel as though some of those maybe last to your day or to this day, rather, and maybe find their way into your playing to this day?
Yeah, they do. It's maybe this resonates with you. Or maybe it resonates with somebody listening, in that you're influenced by somebody like this, or you are influencing someone else like this. But I had a friend named Joe Walmer. No one's ever heard of him. He is not even in a band anymore. I haven't seen or talked to him in years. He had a band called Blind Influence, and I'd go to his house every Sunday. It was like a 25-minute drive, and I'd sit down on the couch, and I'd watch him practice with his band. He had like the effect cymbals. He played blast beats. He was really tight and precise and methodical, and he practiced really hard, and I would stick around after practice and like just try to soak up any information I could. We watched like death metal videos. He introduced me to like Dimmu Borgir and Nile, and he was like big into that stuff just because of the drummers.
Right.
And I knew nothing about it. I really knew nothing about it, but I understood what he was playing, and I would drive home from his house in my Dodge Aries and just like, I would have that feeling like I want to do this. Like, I need to do this. I want to go home and practice. It's where I feel like I'm spending my time better than any other place. When I'm on the kit, that's where I need to be. That's where I am home in a way. And I think Joe was like that too. And of course, August Burns Red over time we started the band, and August Burns Red got bigger than Joe's band, and then they were supporting us, and then we kept going, and they actually ended up breaking up at some point. And, you know, that's just how it goes. Like, the guy that inspired me is working in a factory and not playing drums anymore, and here I am, like, talking about him on a drumming podcast. Like, that's...
Wow. Yeah.
It's funny, but it wasn't some big-name drummer that really got me hooked on this. It was Joe Walmer, and then, like, I would say next in line would be David Husvik from the band Extol. They were on Solid State Records. They're from Sweden or Norway, which they're, again, they're not a band anymore. Yeah. I've gotten to meet him a couple times. He emailed me a couple weeks ago and said he has a new band, and he said, we'd love to support you guys on a tour you do in Europe in the future. And I read it, started replying, and then I stopped. I'm like, what if I would have told my 18-year-old self that the drummer for this band is literally like, we'll pay to be on your tour to support you, you know? Like,
crazy.
But that's how it works. That's how it goes. That's how life is. You're either in one or the other. Either way, both those dudes are some of the best dudes I've ever met. And it's because of that I've had a good experience. And I want to do that same thing for other people, which is part of the reason I teach. Because those guys were so influential on me, not just in a drumming way, but just in a here's how you treat other people way. And it really impacted me.
Tell me a little bit about your first drum set, because that is something that I always kind of laugh about. I was fortunate in that the first drum set that I got from my stepmother, who's no longer alive, but she got me my first, I guess, real drum set at the age of 15. I've been told that I was playing on, like, you know, little toy drum sets that my dad had gotten for me when I was super, super young, so much so that I don't really even recall it. But I certainly remember my first drum set. So tell me a little bit about your first drum set.
Yeah, I had a snare drum with a practice pad. My dad made me play on that for a year before I was allowed to buy a drum set. The reason he did that is because I was into dirt biking, skateboarding, and BMX, and they were all phases. And he thought drumming was going to also be a phase.
Right.
So it was smart. But he said, you need to learn Wipeout, and you need to learn how to play rudiments on this pad. And I didn't, I wasn't real enthusiastic about it, but I stuck with it because I just wanted to have that kit. So about a year later, I had saved up money landscaping. I wrote a check for $850 for a Pearl Export chrome finish.
Nice.
Big toms. I mean, big, like Lars Ulrich size toms.
Power toms.
Yeah, probably. Banked. They were like, I had to like bank them so they actually fit on my kick drum and I could actually play them. But I had that thing for a little while, sold it to my friend Tyler, and then I bought a Mapex M series from my favorite drummer named Jesse Smith. He played for Zayo, and he lied to me and told me it was a Mapex Orion. He had taken off the badges, so I had no way of knowing. I paid $1,500 for this Mapex M series with broken stands and cymbals. And believe it or not, I used that kit and that cymbal setup and stands for, like, 3 years probably with the band.
Wow.
Yeah. And then I got signed by Truth out of Portland, Truth Custom Drums, and I signed a DW in 2013.
Wow, man. So that is the journey. That is the journey of original kit through the deceptive kit,
deceptive kit,
up to everything in between.
Yeah, and I sold that Mapex kit online, and years later, my friend called me. He's like, "Dude, your Mapex is for sale online." It was like a burnt orange. It was impossible to not see. And so I called the kit up. I was like, "Dude, you're trying to sell this kit for $2,000?" I was like, "You know, it's not worth $2,000." And he's like, "Well, it's got your name on it. It was yours." I said, "I know." I said, "And I want to buy it back, and I'll give you $1,000 for it." And he's like,
"Come on."
He's like, "All right, cool." I said, "Great, I'll be right over." So I paid.
You bought that kit back?
I paid too much for it twice.
Come on.
I got ripped off the first time, and I got ripped off the second time. But I had to have it. It was my first, like, real kit, you know?
Right. That is amazing. Do you still have it to this day?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, I haven't sold it. I mean, after this quarantine, maybe I'll need money and I'll have to sell it again and then and buy it back.
It back all over again.
Yeah.
Wow. That is an impressive story. That is too good, man. So throughout the years of Torn and whatnot, are there any particular drummers that you've really been in? Let me rephrase that. Throughout the years of your band touring, are there any particular drummers that you really enjoyed watching live, I guess I should say?
Hmm. Yeah. The drummer for Killswitch Engage is one of my favorites. His name's Justin okay. Foley. He is awesome to watch. He's like professionally, classically, perfectly trained drummer. I've always really liked watching Jordan Mancino from As Lay Dying.
Mm-hmm.
He's very impressive. I love Blake from Between the Buried and Me. And then outside of metal, I like Muse. Their drummer's awesome.
Man, have you ever seen Muse live?
No.
Oh, man. That band is ridiculous. They're so good.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, man. And I tell you what, if you think that guy talking about like the difference between, you know, sometimes you'll hear a drummer on a record and then go see them live and realize that what you know them to be was more of a product of, once again, post-production. I tell you what, when I saw Muse live, I was like, all right, this band does all that live. That vocalist sings all of that and then some live.
Yeah, Matthew Bellamy.
Yeah, man.
He knows what he's doing, man. It's,
yes, he does.
Yeah.
And he is about as a funny-looking Englishman that you could possibly find. But I tell you what, he is singing his ass off.
It's very true.
Oh, man. So between farming and teaching, I guess, is that just the plan, just to ride this thing out going forward and do as many lessons as you can and continue working on the farm until y'all can figure out what's going on with the band, I imagine?
Hmm. That's a good question. I enjoy teaching because I love people. I like helping other people. I like giving other people what I wish someone would have given me. I had really bad drum lessons. There were two instructors. I had George and Clyde Lucas, who were both great, but I had some pretty poor teachers, and I spent a lot of money on it. And I don't like thinking about people spending money on lessons when they're just getting ripped off. And a lot mm-hmm. of the teachers know it. I don't like that. And so I like to teach based on what I wish I would have been taught. It helps me understand. Plus, I have 7 siblings, so I know how to be patient and work with people who are having a hard time understanding. As far as farming, I will always farm because it's a family project. I get to work with my brothers. My 2 brothers also own the farm. And my dad still works with us. So, like, there's no better thing in the world than that. Working with, you know, your 2 brothers and your dad, it's incredible. It's really...
That's awesome.
There's no money in it. The monetary payout is pretty insignificant. But it's hard to quantify what you do get out of farming when you're working with people like that.
Sure.
And then the band, I mean, I'm in a band with the best people. I really don't see us stopping anytime within the next decade. It would have been hard to say that a decade ago, but we've been in a band for 18 years, and it only feels like it's been 8 on one hand, and on the other, it feels like it's been 800. So it's like, what's another 10 years, you know?
Yeah. Wow, man. Right on. Well, best of luck to y'all, and best of luck trying to navigate these uncertain times. And I look forward to the full record coming out, and hopefully everything will work itself out, and I'm pretty sure it will. So best of luck, man.
Yeah, thanks. Hang in there. We'll get through this. It's might take a little while, but we're a resilient country, and Americans are tough, and they love to work. That's why this is so difficult for everybody, because well, it's not an option right now. So
right.
We'll get back. And yeah, thanks a lot for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
Absolutely, man. All right, everybody. Thanks for listening, and thanks to Matt for chatting. Hope you dug it. I'll try to keep getting these out every Monday, and it looks like there's going to be no shortage of remote interviews over the next month or two or three or however long it's going to take. So stay tuned, and we'll catch you on the next one. Crash, bang, boom.